Welcome to East Meets West, episode 314. I'm Tom Merritt.
And I'm Roger Chang.
Wow, we missed July, Roger. What the hell happened?
I think we went on a summer vacation where we did work stuff.
We're not Europeans. We don't go on vacation in August. We just work harder in July. Actually, I did go on a vacation. I went on an actual, like, leave the country holiday.
I know. I heard. You went to Bora Bora.
I did.
You went to one of those locations I first heard about in a novel.
Yeah. I went to James Michener. Actually, it's Ernest Hemingway Land, Bora Bora.
Yes. Is it?
They have an Ernest Hemingway lookalike contest there every year. I didn't get to see it, but.
Oh, do they have various shellfish that have been graven with his image?
Yes. There's always, yeah, you want to try to find the bearded jellyfish that looks like Ernest Hemingway, and then you win a prize.
I can see it now. Someone carved something on the back of a turtle, and every year it swims by the islands, and you got to go out and find it and take a photo.
It's Hawaii for France, is what it is, because it's French Polynesia.
I thought that was Tahiti.
Well, Tahiti and Bora Bora are part of French Polynesia.
Yes.
Yeah.
But so, I figured Tahiti being, I guess you could consider it like the Hawaiian islands.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's what I'm thinking.
Although
Tahiti is the Oahu of French Polynesia.
That is a hell of a flight from Paris. That's like literally on the other side of the planet.
Yeah, I don't know how much longer it is from Paris than it is from LA, because it's like 8 hours from LA.
That's pretty short.
Yeah, it's not bad.
Because
it's actually straight down from Hawaii and then just a little bit farther west.
You know, it's weird because the Big Island of Hawaii is only 4 hours, but if you want to go to Kauai, it's 6.
Yeah, isn't that funny? It doesn't feel like that chain of islands is actually that long, but it is.
But when you look at the map, they're all close together.
Well, yeah. They don't look 2 hours apart on the map.
Yeah, you know.
Well, and French Polynesia, too. Like, you can't fly direct to Bora Bora anymore. Used to be the airport was in Bora Bora because the U.S. Marines built an airport there during World War II, and that was the only airport in French Polynesia for the longest time. But, of course, they eventually built an international airport that could handle bigger jets in Tahiti, in Papeete, Tahiti. So now all the flights are into Papeete, and then you have to take one of the small prop planes and hop over. And those work like buses. They're hilarious, right? Like,
they're filled with people.
They're filled with locals. Everybody gets on, unassigned seats, and then you hop. We actually didn't ever fly directly from Papeete to Bora Bora. We stopped at this island in the middle, and nobody even got out. It was like you landed, they taxied, they turned off the propellers long enough for a couple people to get out, a couple people to get on, like a bus stop.
Totally.
And then they fired it up, taxied out, took off again.
That is one expensive bus.
Yeah, it is.
And there's one very expensive bus.
Well, and they have their own currency. They're not on the euro, obviously.
Well, so it's
Polynesian francs.
But it's weird because technically, so for people who don't know, France is, at least the way the French government sees France, is not just the country of France within Europe. That is what's considered metropolitan France, and then there's their overseas, much like Hawaii and Alaska. Are, although not connected to the U.S., or part of the U.S. So like you were saying, they have French Polynesia, which they consider to be part of France, as well as French Suriname, or is it French Guiana?
French Guiana, I think, yeah. South
America.
Suriname used to be a protectorate like that. What did Suriname used to be? Suriname's next to French Guiana, so it used to be another Guyana.
But it's British, but like, you know, in Hawaii and
it's part of the Netherlands. Dutch Guiana.
Even in Puerto Rico, they use U.S. dollars. I find it weird that they don't use the euro.
Well, because the euro is a European currency. So overseas protectorates can't use it.
But
that's actually one of the interesting things about the pound, right?
Yeah.
The pound sterling can be used in English protectorates. Although, weirdly, the Turks and Caicos Islands, which are a British protectorate,
use
the American dollar, but whatever.
Well, it's because it makes more sense for them financially.
But no, I don't think the euro is allowed to be used outside of Europe. So
but there's
only
like,
metropolitan France can use it. So they had to keep the franc going in French Polynesia. So they have these crazy huge bills. They're like twice the size of American bills. And they're in like ridiculous denominations. It's one of the, like lira. Where you have like 1,000 French Polynesian francs is about $10, a little less.
You know, it's interesting.
A little more, actually.
How currency, in many ways, is often used to kind of unite and buy. I mean, like, you know, when the U.S. first started out, there were many, many different denominations of currency. There wasn't.
Sure. Not currency, although, different. I have a hard time. I don't know my history well enough in this area to know, like, how much of that was just the history of currency. Like, currency mm-hmm. hadn't actually become what it is today with a unified currency in every country anyway. And how much of it was the wild west of the United States.
But, you know, it's just I find it very interesting because it, you know, it's as if, you know, Guam couldn't use the dollar. They had to use the Guanamanian, I don't know.
Right. Well, bill okay. Or something. Actually, it would be more like if Canada, the United States, and Mexico unified their currencies.
It's called the Amero. I know what it is.
Yeah, right? That conspiracy theory about the Amero. Would Guam be allowed to use the Amero?
Why not?
Because that's not, they're not in the continent. They're not in the currency zone.
But, well, at least...
they would have to use the Guamian dollar.
But that's why I find it so interesting that they have it that way, because that means, like...
Well, in other words, I guess what I'm saying is, they would have French Polynesia has a distinct economy. Yeah. And they would, if they were going to use the euro, the Eurozone would have to sign off on that and approve that economy to be a part of the Eurozone. And the Eurozone's like, we're not even letting Latvia in right now. Come on.
I don't know. That whole thing. I think that whole thing is a bit of a mess at this point.
What, the Eurozone?
Yes.
Well, not because of that, though. I mean, yeah, it is a mess.
No, no, it's not because of that specific. Okay. To me, that's a symptom of basically.
I don't think that's a symptom. That makes sense to me. Like we're going to have a zone where this currency is used.
Yeah.
We don't want to have the far flung colonial pieces that are all over the place messing it up. We want
Hawaii
keep it.
Is considered to be part of NAFTA because it's part of the United States.
All right, but Guam isn't part of the United States.
It is. Guam is. Is it part of the United States?
Well, it's
that's
not,
why they say America's
it's not a state
day begins
in the United States. That's all I'm saying.
All right. I think they qualify though
as a state.
No, for provisions.
See,
under
Hawaii and Alaska have to qualify because they're states. You can't have one of your states, one of your official states, not be part of NAFTA.
But that's what I'm saying. I thought, from what I understood of the way the government or the French government looked at it,
that they're like,
French
that's
Polynesia
France?
Is actually part of France.
I don't know. Well, they have they already have a Polynesian franc. It was different than the franc even before the euro.
In any case, welcome back for your vacation.
Thanks.
And then
the exchange rate almost killed me over there.
Was it? Was it
just because I'm used to, like, okay, I can deal with a euro because it's about half, right?
Like
or the pound, where it's like a 1 pound is about 60 cents, right? They're close.
Yeah.
Whereas when it's like 1,000 francs are $9.70 or whatever, $11. I don't remember which way it went.
Just round it up to 10 and lop off 2 zeros.
Yeah, but that's harder in practice than you'd think.
I kind of didn't.
Moving that decimal is an extra step in your head.
Yeah, but when I
and
went
when
to
you're
Japan,
trying to talk French to somebody and do that at the same time.
So who did most of the speaking?
We both. We shared the load. They all speak English. There was never a serious problem. Everybody speaks at least a little bit of English. But I was trying to be, you know, I was trying to be like, I'm in your country. I'm going to try to speak as much French as I'm capable of.
Yeah, well, wouldn't you want to speak whatever French Polynesian or Tahitian.
Yeah, I'm not going to try Tahitian, which they actually speak there. I heard plenty of people speaking Tahitian. It's not like Hawaiian, where older people might speak Hawaiian and people are trying to preserve it, but it's not as common. Tahitian's a very vibrant language. It's what Hawaiian wants to get back to being.
It's such a push-pull. You give it up and you want to go that route and then it's very difficult. I mean, there's a certain economic pull to speak a language that you can do business in.
Well, and that's what's interesting. Like, Tahitian has persevered pretty well. And I don't know if that's just because of the isolation of the islands.
I think it's because of the isolation and the French government subsidizes the economy of Tahiti.
Sure.
Like, so you don't necessarily, That, and unlike the United States, which pretty much saw as any far-flung outpost a perfect place to put an air base and a navy port and a military, you know, barracks. I mean, it's a lot of those things that cropped up. Like, for example, Guam, a lot of those stores and stuff were there to service the service personnel at the Navy base and stuff. So it's just kind of an outgrowth.
Well, because you look at – I always like to look at disparate examples of this, right? So you have Ireland, where Irish is making a bit of a comeback, but really everybody speaks English. You have Wales, where Welsh never went as far away as, say, Cornish, but it got pretty close to being extinguished.
Oh, okay. I wasn't sure what you're – whether – well, isn't there an active, at least in Wales, an active push to kind of preserve Welsh? Yeah. And they teach it in grade school.
They've done a lot to try to bring it back, same as Irish. They've done a lot to try to bring it back. Hawaii is that kind of in that same area where, but I'm curious, like, why did those countries almost lose their languages? Whereas Catalan, Tahitian, some even Basque, they were just as subsumed. And you made some good points about Tahitian in particular, but they're just as subsumed by the overriding culture, and yet their language held on.
This is my theory on that. I don't know how well it holds up. Is that the more the less resistance that overriding culture has to you, like basically more accepting, the less you feel that you need to kind of have that kind of almost ethno-nationalistic streak where I'm Catalan, so I'll speak Catalonian, you know, not Spanish, and so you know you don't have that in. And one thing,
that doesn't work in Ireland because they were not happy about the English being there. In Ireland, what happened was the English came in and said it is against the law to speak Irish.
Yes, that, and they moved a bunch of Irish out, and you know there was all. I mean, they did the same thing with the Scots, like out you go. Basically, Imperial Britain's policy was to kind of dilute. So we'll put you in different parts of the empire so you can all get together and become a threat. You know, it was very interesting because for a good number of years, there was actually in the U.S. was it the 50s or 60s? I think for most of the beginning half of the 20th century, in Louisiana, it was illegal to speak French in school. Like, they did not teach it. They taught you English, even though Louisiana was purchased through the Louisiana Purchase from the French. And a lot of the people there were French-speaking individuals, and English was their second language. And it was still that way well into the middle of the 20th century.
Was it illegal to speak Hawaiian at one point? I feel like it was. If it wasn't actually illegal, it was all but illegal. Like
I think it was the same way that they did it with the Native American reservations, where in school you were forbidden to speak it.
Okay.
And there,
it wasn't illegal to go out and around and speak it. Like Irish, like if you were caught speaking Irish at certain points in history, you would be thrown in jail.
I could be wrong, but I don't think so.
I don't think it was like that in Hawaii. But you're saying like they basically just said, we're not going to speak Hawaiian in schools or in any official capacity.
You're speaking English only, and that's what we're teaching you. And, you know, especially when you deal with young, you know, individuals in the education setting, it has a huge impact.
Definitely.
So it's, you know, I mean, I'm sure there's our listeners could give us countless other, you know, reasons why. But, you know, language is one of those core cultural identity markers that people love to hang on to jealously. I mean, think about what we have here. We have issues with, you know, with anti-immigration groups. Oh, we don't want to speak Spanish. Blah, blah, blah. It's English. Because that is such a powerful, you know, cultural touchstone for a lot of people, and you can't really mess with that because you're messing with my identity.
Well, there's a certain amount of tribalism involved there, and that is at the core of it. But when people are speaking a language that you don't speak, you feel stupid. You feel left out.
I think you feel disenfranchised.
I think you feel stupid too. I think you feel both. I mean, you feel disenfranchised. You feel left out, and you feel like maybe those people aren't going to think I'm as smart as I know I am. or as confident or strong or whatever. You don't have the edge.
I think
the reaction is to say you're not allowed to speak that language, or speaking that language is what stupid people do, and therefore, you know, we're going to try to turn the tables on you.
I think it's, are they talking about me? I don't understand.
That's definitely part of it.
I think a lot of it is.
Are they laughing at me? Are they telling jokes about me?
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, it's, you know, I've had issues, you know, with that, where people's like, oh, what are you saying? It's like, I don't know. I just said, you know, my mom would ask me something in Chinese. And most people were curious. They weren't they weren't belligerent about it. They're just curious.
What'd you tell your mom about me?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, you know, they'll joke about it. But, you know, the back of the head, it's like, oh, did they say something bad?
They're joking, but there's a little kernel of truth in that joke. Because we don't know. And so we try to fill in the gaps. And if you don't speak the language at all, you can't really fill in the gaps. That's why even knowing just a little bit of a language can be extraordinarily helpful. Because you'll hear words and go, oh, they're talking about dishwashing. Okay.
Yeah. Well, I do it with Latin American talk shows or Spanish-speaking talk shows. And I shouldn't say Latin America because, like, 89% of it's, like, produced either in Mexico City or Miami or Houston or L.A. But, you know, it's like, what are they talking about? It's like, oh, homosexuals, they're talking about gay rights or blah, 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 more. Oh, that person cheated on that woman. Now he's upset because that's their version of Jerry Springer. It's interesting. It's you pick up little bits and pieces, and it's funny how much you understand by body language and by tone.
Unless just the language, cadence and tone and looks, but just body language, but facial expressions.
It's unfortunately I read better Spanish than I can hear. Although I find that certain Spanish accents are easier for me. Like Colombian is a lot easier for me to understand than like a Mexican Spanish accent.
Really? Huh. Yes. That's interesting. You'd think it would be the opposite because you would have been exposed to Mexican accents more frequently in the United States than Colombian accents.
Colombia doesn't have a lot. It's not as harsh in the way they enunciate things. So it sounds more like my teacher pronouncing it. Mm. So I can understand it. It's like if someone was learning English and they learned it through, you know, whatever system they had in their country. And then you talk to someone from the Midwest or you talk to someone and you try to talk to someone from like the Bronx. You know, you have that kind of thick, you know, almost accented Spanish. And it's like, I understand it, but not everything you said. But you talk to someone who has a less strong accent. You know, to it, it's a little easier to understand.
Well, that just ties into the fact that we differentiate our own languages' accents much better than accents of other languages we don't speak because they just sound foreign anyway.
Mandarin is really weird because Chinese Mandarin from China is enunciated slightly differently than the Taiwanese Mandarin that I'm used to. So I'm always kind of trying to figure out what they're saying. If I'm watching a Taiwanese show, I have a much easier time like saying, oh, it's a dating game and they're asking these to be. Because most of my Chinese is basically surrounded by, you know, what I wanted for dinner and, you know, do you have my money and all that stuff. But
what did you do with your T-shirt?
Yeah, like if I watch their news, so like I understand various words, but sometimes it's hard for me to understand.
Well, and I guess that is similar in English anyway to hearing a British or a Scottish, especially accent speaking English.
Or
but
like,
the accent is so different, it can be hard to make out.
But I mean, even in England, there's dozens of different, you know, accents that I have.
And that's a good point. I say it's harder to distinguish foreign language accents, but then Americans have a notoriously hard time telling different English accents, just English accents apart.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, there's just so many of them. That was all I was going to say. I mean, many more than you would think. Some people are good, like, I can tell five or six English accents apart reliably, but I know that there's many more.
Well, it's interesting because, like, when you grow up, you assume the BBC style standard of English is kind of what everyone speaks, and it's not the case. And it's a little jarring because you have an expectation, and then someone comes out with a Geordie accent or a Yorkshire accent. It's like, oh, I not quite what I expected. Because I think if you know you're going into a situation where you're going to talk with someone with a slightly more difficult, you know, intonation that you have to understand. You kind of train yourself. You're like, oh, I'm going to be ready and be super ready to listen and kind of decode everything they say. But if you're not, if you're just kind of wandering into it, it's like, oh, I don't understand.
Well, and that's why I think some people can watch Trainspotting and not have to see the subtitles with some of the accents. And other people are like, I have no idea what these people are saying. It's just the amount of work that you can put into trying to decode it.
It's so it's so interesting you say that, because I remember when I was in Australia, I was with at the time girlfriend's friend's house, and she was asking me, it's like, can you Americans not understand our accent? Because I watch shows with like her interviewing an Australian, you have to subtitle everything he says. It's like, some people might have a difficult
time. I don't see subtitles for Australians usually. Where was that?
She was saying it was like on a news report, not news report, I forgot what show, but this is back in like 2001, 2002. So I have no idea, but she asked me that.
Well, and it's also experience, right?
Yeah.
So Australians probably have more experience hearing American accents simply because of movies and TV shows, if nothing else, than we have of hearing Australian accents. It's less so today than it used to be with the internet. But where would you hear an Australian accent on American TV in the 70s? Almost nowhere. And then you probably didn't run into a whole lot of Australians in your daily life if you're working, you know, in Minnesota.
I'm sure you'd be surprised. Like, there's a ton of, I don't know.
Yeah, now we're going to get a post. We're going to get a post on the blog. It's like, actually, Minnesota has the highest number of Australians per capita of any state in the United States.
It's actually California.
There's a very well-known Australian commune in Minneapolis.
Actually, you know what? The weirdest place I saw an Australian store was in San Antonio. I was checking out the Alamo, as you do as a tourist.
Sure.
I was walking along the street, and there was Taste of it. It was basically like a large general store, but it just had chock full of Australian candies.
See, but that kind of stuff happens in touristy areas, right? Because...
But that's not what I expect. I mean, I'm in San Antonio next to the Alamo. I expect Alamo-ish things.
I think there's two reasons why that happens. Because there's also a Scottish store near Union Square in San Francisco. And I think what happens is you have a cross section of, hey, we'll get some people from, let's take the Australian store in San Antonio. We'll get some people from Australia who are coming to San Antonio to visit, maybe getting a little homesick, willing to come in and be like, oh my gosh, they got Australian stuff here, and this is awesome. And we'll get some people who come into San Antonio from elsewhere in the United States who are just like, wow, Texas, it's different, it's new. And then see like, oh my gosh, Australian stuff, that's even weirder and new. And you build a business off that.
What's it called? I think it's right here. It's called the Australia Shop. It's called About Australia. It's located near the junction of Highway 280 and Loop 410. See map 2 for street map. So yeah, I think that was it. Those are interesting. They sell boomerangs. Boomerangs are the big things. Boomerangs, kangaroos, and
are boomerangs a big thing anymore? I feel like that's cliche.
And didgeridoos. I don't know. I mean,
didgeridoos are the new boomerang.
Do you ever get a case of cultural cringe when you're abroad and you see something like, you know, that's like American? You look at it, it's like, it's kind of the stereotypical American, but it's not like.
Well, it's not my experience of the United States, but it's definitely. I never see them and go, they've got it all wrong. I see them and go, yeah, that's an image that the country projects sometimes. I get why they would think that.
I always get a slight chuckle because like in the
definitely
like, you know, when I was in Japan, just like, you know, the American food is like, I guess, you know, it has.
Well, I'm sure that happens in reverse, right?
Yeah, it has the same ingredients. I guess
I'm sure Japanese people come to the United States and go, that's your sushi. Okay.
Well, it's so funny. That's what's so ridiculous. Like, you know, there's a sushi place over here up on West Portal. A street near me, and it's called Fuji Sushi.
Yeah, I know Fuji. I've been there.
But their rolls are huge. Like, when you get one of the things, they're like, they're size of like a half dollar.
Yeah.
And you go to Japan, and they're all like little bite-sized morsels. And it's interesting because, you know, in sushi, or at least in traditionally, you're supposed to be able to put the whole thing in your mouth and eat it. But like, you know, the ones at Fuji are like, you need two or three bites to actually finish it off. And it's just like, yeah, you know, I think they come here and think we're just a bunch of like, you know.
Let's Americanize it. Well, Chinese food's the same way. The Chinese food in the United States is bears a tangential relationship to the food that is eaten in, say, even Beijing, right?
Well, it's there are many different styles, and what you have happen is that
mishmash. So,
yeah, you kind of have like, you know, because, you know, businesses survive on patronage, and so they need to sell something that people are willing to buy. In this case, food.
Thank you for the lesson in economics.
Well, no, but so a lot of Chinese restaurants make out like the beef and broccoli, General right. Chow's chick, because they know those things will sell, but it's not necessarily what they're good at making. And it's interesting because if I go eat Chinese food with my parents, and my mom will say, I want it done this way, this way, this way, tastes entirely different than if you just ordered it off the menu. Like if you're a white guy and you ordered it off, it'd be a completely different taste. In fact, I had this with a coworker. They used to order Chinese food. It's like, you know, we always have Chuck order it because Chuck was one of their other IT guys, and he was Chinese. It's like when he orders it, it's like tastes so much better. It's totally different than when we, you know, than one of us calls in and says, you know, we want to order a bunch of stuff, because they make assumptions that you're not going to like it because right. it's, you know, it's not sweet, it's not salty. It, you know, there's a lot of things. There's a lot of foods. I took Jen to my cousin's wedding. During one of the, it was just kind of the seafood banquet, but there's a lot of foods in there that she, actually most of it she couldn't eat. It's like they had the sea cucumber, mm-hmm. and it's like, you know, she's trying to pick up a little piece with her chopsticks. It would hold what she called a gluten or gelatinous beef lasagna, which is basically, you know, all the tendons and a cartilage okay. melted, and you know, it forms as a little jelly, which is, you know, good if you like it. I mean, right. I'm willing to eat it. Which is like, what's this? What's that? But it's weird because, you know, you can actually get Chinese style Chinese food, but you need to order it either with a Chinese person or someone who's very familiar with, you know, a Chinese.
You should start you should make a book, maybe an Amazon Kindle single of tips for white people to order proper Chinese food. Like, what do they have to say?
But that's the thing. I don't think they would eat it. I really don't.
I would. I'm the
well,
one who's
I know
like,
you would.
I go in and I order salt and pepper prawns, which isn't even that weird. And they're like, are you sure you don't want just prawns? Like, no, I want the freaking heads on the freaking prawns, and I want
actually,
to bite the heads off.
All
right.
It's so much work. It's gross. Then I used to peel shrimp. I peeled shrimp for my uncle.
You don't peel shrimp.
No, I had to peel. I'm saying, as a job during one summer, I had to peel shrimp from my
restaurant. I see.
So I know what's inside a shrimp, and I don't want the whole thing.
Dude, you have to have them deveined. Jeez.
Well, yeah, but you can't devein it with the shell still on.
You can.
No, you can. It's on the back. They're turd channel.
Yeah, it's all hot. You hot it out. It's all good. Crunchy. Prawn heads, man. Mm-mm-mm. Eat those eyes,
you know,
eat those brains.
You know, it's
chicken
it's
feet.
One of
the, actually, the thing about chicken feet is I don't get enough flavor out of chicken feet.
Well, but see, that's the thing. You're eating it wrong. It's not really a food you make a meal out of. It's a snack that you just kind of mindlessly chew on.
Yeah, no, that's why you don't want to get it at a restaurant, because you're thinking an appetizer and you're like, there's not enough here.
But I can tell you one thing I find very interesting. At least I noticed this in the past 8 years, that during Thanksgiving, you know, when you get your normal roast duck at the Chinese bakery or store, during that lead up to Thanksgiving, they start offering, you know, roast turkey done the same way, and they just hang it up in the front and you put in your order. It's great.
Yeah, it's good.
They cook it for you. It's roasted. I mean, come on.
It's funny how traditions like that will migrate into the migrants. You know, they'll embrace it. Eileen tells the story about how they never really had turkey at Thanksgiving until she was older. And then her parents just suddenly kind of turned on a dime, because her parents were from the Philippines originally, and were like, you know, we should start having turkey. And then they started having turkey. So it's not like they were resisting it. It just kind of took a while for them to go, oh, well, we live here now.
You know,
we should do the turkey thing. Why not?
You know, like my parents never really cooked turkey until after we ate at my cousin's place, because the same uncle I was peeling shrimp for, it was for a Chinese restaurant, made this huge turkey and had everyone, and so it's like, turkey's not too bad. You know, I think it's just part of it is like you haven't had it. Like until I had Mexican food in grade school, I did like, oh, what's Mexican food? Like I had no idea.
I've always been an adventurous eater too, so I have a different, I have a kind of a skewed perspective on.
I have a very delicate constitution.
Yes,
so
I know. Generally... Roger goes out. If you don't know people, Roger goes out with a parasol and a fan.
I wish.
He has his man at arms with him at all times. To,
I will say one thing I'm very interested in, and though maybe not tasting, but at least trying a few times, are those like weird survival foods that you see, yeah, like yeah. MREs. I don't know why, but
I've eaten MREs. Have you never eaten an MRE?
The only ones I've ever eaten, I think it was like spaghetti or something. Like it was really good, but I've heard people say like there's like the pork and beans are really bad. Like there's like five or six ones are just.
I always like the ham and egg omelet.
Huh? Is it just one thing that comes out?
Yeah, it comes out as one gelatinous square. But it was. I mean, it's not good, but it was pretty good for that. I roomed with a guy who was in the National Guard Reserve, and he was in charge of buying all the MREs for maneuvers whenever they went out. And so he got to keep whatever they didn't use and kept them around the house. So I went through a bunch of them.
I wonder if they're good for you. I mean, there must be high in sodium and stuff to preserve.
Yeah, pretty salty. And they were definitely high in calories because you're supposed to be out on maneuvers. So
yeah. So not so good if you have a sedentary lifestyle.
They always had a dessert of some sort. They always had
the freeze-dried ice cream. That was the other thing I liked.
What's that?
The freeze-dried ice cream. That was the other thing I liked.
Oh, yeah. I love that stuff. That never came in MREs, but I always want to get the freeze-dried pizza, though. And they don't ever have it anymore. At the museums, they always have the freeze-dried ice cream. They even have freeze-dried cookies, but they never carry the freeze-dried pizza because it was awful. Don't get me wrong. But I just think it was kind of hilarious.
There's one dish I've been meaning to try, and the only reason I've been meaning to try is because, you know, back when my mom still had the coffee shop, there were a bunch of customers who all went through World War II and in Korea, the Korean War. But they would always talk about SOS, you know, shit on the shingle, which is basically chipped beef and like country or some gravy over toast. And they always talk about it as like, you know, it's one of those things. It's one of those things that you remember, you know, from your service in the military. And so I've always been interested in it. And then I more recently noticed that there are a bunch of videos online on how to cook it, but they don't use chipped beef. They use, ground beef instead. So, but it's one of those things. Hey, I kind of try it once. It seems very interesting, possibly life threatening, but gotta try it once.
Gotta try everything once. Well, we tried taking July off once, so sorry for that, and thank you for your patience. But as we've mentioned before, East Meets West is, we do it for fun, and if you get some fun out of it, by golly, everybody wins. So we'll do another one soon, we promise. In the meantime, you can find us at subbrilliant.com/EMW. We'll see you later.
Bye.
About this and other shows, visit frogpants.com. Audio program so good, it's like you're there.